My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Dawson Carr. He's the Janet and Richard Geary Curator of European Art at the Portland Art Museum. And he's here to talk about Giese's altarpiece, which is on show now at the museum through July the 9th. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Dawson.
Always a pleasure, Joseph.
As you go into the you go up the stairs in the museum towards European Art, the main gallery, which is the one on the right, it has this altarpiece, which is sort of burnished wood frame and lots of gold leaf, and there are nine images. And this altarpiece has been restored and collected. All the panels have been reassembled because they were scattered by different owners. You're going to talk about what the stories are, and then there's a particular special feature that one of the panels was lost, so it was recreated by a contemporary artist. So just tell us who is on the panels, on the altarpiece.
Well, the altarpiece is devoted to St. John the Evangelist, and it was created in the 1370s by an artist whose name is Francescuccio Giese. And sometime in the late 19th or early 20th century, the altarpiece was sold from its original location and sawed apart, dismembered, so that each of the pieces could be sold separately. And this was in part a means to get more money overall for it, and in part a response to the interest in early Italian painting in the early 20th century. But people in their homes had little galleries and the like, and they wanted something. Individual scenes were more appropriate, and so it really made them more desirable on the market.
And it came from a church on the east coast of Italy?
That's right. The region is known as the Marche. We say the Marches in English. And it's the region in central Italy that its eastern border is the Adriatic Sea, and its western border are the fabulous Apennine Mountains. And Giese worked in an area around the town of Fabriano, which is in the foothills leading up to those mountains. And it may well be that this altarpiece, we're not at all sure about its original location, but it may well be that it originated in a church dedicated to St. John the Evangelist in Fabriano, which was destroyed. It was demolished in the late 19th century. So that may have been the time at which the altarpiece was sold off and the like. Mm-hmm. But we have no records, and so we can't really be sure.
It's amazing there are no records of the church. It's pure.
Well, its existence is known, but nothing specific about it. There's no descriptions of the interiors that survive, and so we can't really be sure, but that seems like a likely possibility.
And do you think it was cut up in Italy and divided and spread around Italy first, or straight to the U.S.?
I would assume that it was cut up in Italy, and it was sold off by Italian art dealers, and it just so happens that all of the existing panels ended up in American museums. Mm-hmm. And that's just happenstance. But that's what made it possible for us to reunite all of the individual elements, put them back in a newly made framework so that it can be displayed and these works of art can be seen as they were originally. I should say that the most important thing for us here in Portland is that it features one of our paintings, a painting given to us in 1961 by the Samuel H. Kress Foundation. And it's very precious here in Portland because it's a narrative scene. It tells a story as opposed to being a Madonna and child. We have images of the crucifixion and of the nativity, yes, but they're rather commonplace. To have an interesting, different sort of narrative scene is absolutely crucial to represent the early Renaissance because good storytelling, good, clear, human-centered storytelling is really at the heart of what the Renaissance is about.
So this is, would you call this early Renaissance?
Yes.
Okay, so the figures are, how would you describe that? I mean, in terms of perspective and how lifelike the figures are?
Well, Giese is making efforts toward perspective, but they're not very profound yet. Gysi belongs to the generation after the great Giotto in Florence, and they're human-centered in that they tell the stories with gesture and expression. And yes, they are rather flat by comparison to what it would be 100 years later, but the clarity with which the stories are told was really the most important thing to the people at this time. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that this was the way that people really learned and had these stories set in their heads, because most were illiterate. It's perfectly possible that Gysi was illiterate as well. It wouldn't have been at all unusual. And he would have had the stories read to him by a priest. People would have heard the stories repeated over and over again in church. And this was a way to encourage their meditation on those stories without someone reading to them. They would have all known these stories.
And do you think your average peasant would have got up close enough to the altar to see this? Is it just for the priests and the high ups?
No, it was very much meant for the people. Now, we don't know. It could have been on the high altar of a small church or perhaps in a chapel. Mm-hmm. We just don't know. So still, people would have been able to read this. And in the gallery, you can see, even from 20 paces away, it's very legible. It's very mm-hmm. clear.
So these are panels. It is a kind of narrative, you know. We compare everything now to manga and graphic novels and that kind of thing. There are no words anyway, and there's no Latin to decipher. So what's St. John the Baptist up to in these pictures?
St. John the Evangelist, in the center panel, the large center panel.
Is this a different St. John?
No, this is the one and the same. It's St. John the Evangelist, not the Baptist.
Okay.
St. John the Evangelist is shown in the center panel, the large center panel, at the foot of the cross, at the crucifixion, one of the witnesses. He narrates the scene in his gospel. And around this large central image of Christ on the cross, with St. John looking out at us, are eight smaller scenes taken from his life, not from the gospels, but from an account of his life in what is known as the Golden Legend. The Golden Legend was a collection of stories about the major saints that was compiled by a prelate whose name was Jacobus de Voragine toward the end of the 1200s, and it became very popular. There's 1,000 manuscript copies mm-hmm. known.
So this would have been in Latin.
Absolutely.
And how would a normal person have had it read to them?
It would have been most probably by the priest instructing the artist, reading the stories to him and instructing the artist that you need to represent this, and this.
Mm-hmm. And who would be reading the book for religious purposes?
Once again, the priest. And mm-hmm. priests would, of course, they wouldn't necessarily use the stories with their congregations in Latin. They would translate it
okay,
for them.
Right.
And I should say that, of course, the printing press isn't invented. It's another couple of generations before the printing press comes into being. But as soon as it does, there are copies of the Golden Legend issued in all languages,
oh,
all
really?
European languages. It's that popular. And so it was a standard source to go to. And in this case, we've provided a copy of the Golden Legend in the gallery so that people can sit and read the full stories and see exactly what Gysi would have known. Mm-hmm. But we've also provided a panel that visitors can pick up and carry and stand in front of the altarpiece that tell the stories in an abbreviated fashion mm-hmm. So that they can follow them one to the other.
So if the listener imagines a long horizontal panel, about 12 feet long?
That's right.
And there's a central crucifixion scene, which is a large rectangle. Either side of that are four square panels, and they're numbered 1 to 4 clockwise. So 1 to 4 and then 5 to 8 are on the other side, on the right side. So the first one, number one, is the one owned by the Portland Art Museum?
That's right. It represents the resurrection of Drusiana. Drusiana was a great friend of the saints, and he had been out proselytizing and returned to Ephesus. And as soon as he had arrived in the city, he encounters her funeral cortege. They're carrying her on her funeral bier, and the mourners tell him, oh, she had so hoped to see you one last time. And he says, in the name of my Lord Jesus Christ, rise to life. And she does, and then she goes off and cooks him a meal.
Oh.
Yes.
And so Portland owns this, and this was, we got this from
the Samuel H. Kress Foundation.
And he was a kind of a five-and-dime magnate who
That's right.
spread his wealth and his art.
Many of your listeners will, at least your older listeners, will remember the Kress five-and-dime stores. And he had stores across the country and went to Europe and bought like Randolph Hearst. I mean, he just bought and bought and bought. He had the money to buy the best. And he gave the very greatest things to the National Gallery of Art in Washington. And there are room after room of Kress paintings in Washington. And he gave a number of very great things to the Metropolitan Museum in New York as well. And then he took the collection, which numbers about 3,000 objects, and he spread it around America in the cities in which he had done business and done well. And so places, little places like Portland, got 28 paintings. And the Italian Renaissance and Baroque would essentially not be represented in the Portland Art Museum if it were not for Samuel H. Kress. Mm-hmm. It's one of the great, great stories in the history of art and art museums in America.
And then presumably our painting was on display or...
Yes, and normally we display it, but like many others, as an independent work on the wall by itself in a frame. And this exhibition gives people the opportunity to see it in its original context. That's mm-hmm. really the major reason we wanted to do this.
What's another panel that maybe should focus on?
They're great, great stories. And they're stories of St. John's miracles and teachings. And they're really done to impress. The miracles were wrought not in and of themselves, but to win over souls. And the Drusiana story, for instance, ends that all who had witnessed this cried, John's God is the one true God. And so it's really about proselytizing. I mean, John was the evangelist. One of the stories that people will enjoy very much is a philosopher whose name was Crato advised two rich young men to despise the riches of the world and to show it by selling everything that they had and buying these fabulous jewels, which he then takes and smashes. John comes along and says, look, the rejection of wealth is only meritorious when it benefits the poor. And so he says a prayer over the stones. They come back together and are sold to benefit the poor. And this impresses not only the two young men who were involved, who begin to follow John, but many others around as well. Another story tells about John being hauled in to a pagan temple, and the populace wanted to force him to sacrifice to the goddess Diana, and he refused to do this and prayed aloud, got everyone out of the temple, prayed aloud, and the temple collapsed. And we see the temple in the act of collapsing in the painting. And it's the one place in the altarpiece in which the artist does not follow the account in the Golden Legend. Because he does not represent the goddess Diana, who's very clearly specified. He represents a male god, and a male god draped. And this really can be for only one reason. He was probably instructed to do that, and it was about early fears of the female form and the temptations that it brought. That's probably the reason.
Right. And the god he depicts is not a... horned devil or anything?
No, not at all. It's probably either Zeus or perhaps Ares, one of the Greek gods.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Dawson Carr. He's the Janet and Richard Geary Curator of European Art at the Portland Art Museum. And he's here talking about Geary's altarpiece, which is on show now at the museum through July the 9th. So these 8+1 stories, do they follow a total narrative? Are we supposed to meet John at the beginning and be transformed, he's transformed by the end, or we are?
No, it's more a series of miraculous events. And the final panel in the lower right corner has been lost. We're kind of hoping that the attention that the exhibition is generating is going to cause it to come from out of the woodwork. I should also say that most of the works of art that you see in art museums today from this period are of this kind. They're taken out of much bigger ensembles, and it's more the rule than the exception. It's very rare to find completely preserved altarpieces outside of churches. Certainly, they still exist and have long existed in churches, but those removed from churches are usually suffer the fate of the Geary altarpiece.
At the time things like this were cut up, you know, 19th century, were they still considered sort of folk art, almost like you're getting something cheap and it's not museum quality, you're going to keep it in your home and it's just like authentic?
No, it went more to sophisticated collectors, because the field of early Italian painting was very hot in the first half of the 20th century. It was one of the key collecting areas. It's what people wanted. And so it was very lucrative. People wanted just this sort of thing.
Right. So tell us about panel number, is it number eight?
Well, actually, panel number nine. It's it's the last of the smaller panels, and it's been lost. And my colleague David Steele at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and in North Carolina is the institution that that truly did this, that truly put it all together. David and his colleagues in North Carolina have been working on this thing for about 25 years, trying to get this to happen. And one of the reasons it happened was Portland came along and said, we'll help, we'll do it too, because we want it for our audience as well. And that last scene has been reconstructed. David and his colleagues got together and, reading the Golden Legend, came up with the most likely final scene. It follows on the scene that comes right before, and it represents the baptism of a doubter, of someone who truly doubted St. John. And in the previous scene, he asks him to prove his status and God's power by drinking poison. And the poison has no effect on him. And this finally convinces this man that that John represents the one true God. And the final scene shows John baptizing him.
And who is the artist who did the work?
It's Francescuccio Ghisi.
No, who is the contemporary artist who painted
it? I'm sorry. Her name is Charlotte Caspers, and she's a paintings conservator based in Amsterdam, who's made a specialty of this kind of historic painting reconstruction. And the North Carolina Museum brought Charlotte over, and she worked with them. They came up with a composition based on the figures in the rest of the altarpiece and created this scene. And she did so using the materials and techniques that Ghisi would have used. We know specifically that certain pigments were used because the original panels have been scientifically tested. And so we know from those identifications some of the pigments. Others, we can assume, based on a treatise from the next generation, from the early 15th century, in which it's by an artist in Florence whose name is Cennino Cennini, and he lays out the whole process of creating a panel painting.
Is it, this is like a textbook he laid down for everyone
exactly.
else?
Exactly. It was meant to help artists. And a lot of it is just practical information. Some of it is, oh, you might use this and think it's going to be a wonderful pigment. And it may be a beautiful red when you put it on, but it will not last. And so avoid it. Mm-hmm. That kind of practical advice gets conveyed. And the creation of the panel by Charlotte Caspers enabled us to take the exhibition even further, and we are displaying most of the pigment types that Giese used, both in their powdered form and in their natural form. There are a group of mineral pigments, one animal-based pigment. It's a red that comes from a scale insect that lives off the Kermes oak in Europe, and it produces a beautiful red dye. This is kind of interesting because this gets supplanted once America is discovered, and American cochineal is discovered, which produces an even better red dye. But this is too early for that. America's not yet discovered, and so they're working off of these little, they're pregnant insects, and they look like little berries, and you'll be able to see these.
Mm-hmm. This is a big table with a glass top, and inside are little bowls with crushed up powder of different colors, kind of reds and browns and yellows.
And blues and greens and some of the pigments come from plants, are dyes, and others are fabricated. They're made by people. The basic white that was used was lead white, and it was made by suspending a coil of lead over vinegar fumes, and a white crust develops and is scraped off, and it makes this wonderful white that was used throughout European painting until it was really outlawed only in the 1970s as toxic.
What was the other white that supplanted it?
The white that supplanted it doesn't get really invented until the 19th century, and that's titanium. And that's truly supplanted lead white. Other forms of white, chalk-based, were known at the time, but they weren't nearly as resilient. And I should say, many of your listeners will have seen images of X-rays of paintings that show their structure. And it's this lead white that gets mixed with virtually everything, even black, that enables us to read X-rays. The lead stops the rays and creates the image.
Right. So all this scientific work had already been done before the woman started painting.
That's right. And she knew the techniques of the time. And there's a video in the exhibition that shows in about 3 minutes' time how one of these panels is made. It's very clear. It has no narration, but it is very clear.
It's brilliant because it shows, there is one image showing all the different layers from the last layer of gold leaf that you see right down to the wooden block, the panel it's painted.
Nine separate steps.
Yeah, and you explain what egg tempura is. I mean, it's
egg yolk provided.
Tempura.
Egg tempura was the basic medium, the stuff that bound the pigment together. And egg yolk was nearly perfect. It was what painters used for another century before oil really starts supplanting tempera paint. And there's also the gilding process is treated in another case. And this is the laying of very, very thin sheets of gold onto the backgrounds in these scenes. The gold leaf also was used on the frame, the frame being created, in this case, in modern times, in our times. And this case shows gold leaf, shows the tools that were used to manipulate it, to burnish it, to do punch work, to create patterns in it. And we have one really interesting little moment, and we show a Venetian gold ducat, one of the standard coins used throughout Europe at the moment.
Solid gold?
Solid gold, 3.5 grams of gold. And this small little coin, and we managed to find one from Gizzi's time, from the reign of Doge Andrea Contarini. And Cennino Cennini, the artist who wrote the treatise for artists, tells us that an expert could hammer out 100 to 125 sheets of gold leaf 3 inches square from one gold ducat. And when people see the size of this gold ducat, they're going to be amazed. And because it really is pounding this out to these infinitesimally thin sheets. Now, modern methods would get 150 sheets. It's that much
thinner.
Do they
use electrolysis now, or do they still use pressure?
I think it's still pressure.
Okay.
But I don't know, Joseph. I really don't.
But the, I mean, really, when I see an artist now using gold leaf, it's pretty much the same, right? They have a little square.
It's pretty much the same. It's a bit bigger. It's
a flat knife thing.
That's right. They use a knife to cut it, and they use a what's called a tip. It's a kind of brush, often with horsehair, and you wipe this brush on your forehead or your cheek to pick up a little skin oil and just place it over the leaf. The leaf attaches itself to this brush, and then you go to the panel, and on the panel, wherever you've wanted gold leaf, you've put a layer of red bole. Bole was a kind of red clay, kind of greasy.
How do you spell bole?
B-O-L-E.
Okay.
And bowl was laid wherever you wanted the gold leaf, and you wet it just before you apply it. And then with the tip, you just hold the gold leaf above the surface, and it's drawn down on to the red bowl, and then it's burnished.
Mm-hmm.
And often in Gizzi's time, they used something that was readily available, and that was dog's teeth to burnish.
Burnish means that rub it? So
rub it
shiny.
So that it gets very, very shiny, and so that you you can make it so that the seams between each of the sheets all but disappears as well.
And the other thing is with computers at Duke, they artificially aged the new picture?
Yes. It was understood that this bright, gleaming new panel would look out of place alongside all of these others that had aged for 650 years. And so they turned to the math department at Duke University. And these students came up with algorithms that, based on the crack patterns that develop naturally in this kind of painting, and the diminution in color of the original panels, they then photographically aged the newly made panel, and the photograph has been inserted in the altarpiece, and we're showing the newly made panel right beside it. And people will be able to see this looked very different originally. It was much brighter and more gleaming. And they realized that they could also take these image processing techniques and go the other way. And so they came up with algorithms to photographically rejuvenate the 650-year-old panels. And visitors will be able to see this in a video monitor in the gallery.
Yeah, I mean, it takes up a whole gallery, and it really tells a great story. I mean, the painting itself is narrative, but this exhibition shows you how things were made in a really accessible way, with cards, videos, objects under glass. It's like you're not going to breeze by this one. You're going to like stay for an hour and a half if you want to really absorb it. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you, Joseph.
And Portland only has it until July the 9th. So what's happening after that?
Then all the paintings go back to their homes, the Chicago Art Institute, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and the North Carolina Museum
of Art. That's terrible. You're going to break it all up again?
It's going to all get broken up again.
Why?
Well, because all of these works of art are owned by these institutions, and they want them back, naturally enough. We want ours back, too.
Can't you just agree to share them?
I think in this case, probably not. It's emphasizes, though, your question emphasizes that this is something very special. This doesn't happen very often because it's very difficult to get institutions to lend works to be used in this way, taken out of the frames they normally reside in, inserted in an altarpiece, and the like. So I'm truly hopeful, and I do think Portlanders will really enjoy this opportunity to expand upon one of the great works in our collection.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Dawson Carr. He's the Janet and Richard Geary Curator of European Art at the Portland Art Museum. And he was talking about Giese's altarpiece on display at the museum through July the 9th. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thanks very much, Joseph. Always a pleasure.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Good afternoon, KBOO listeners. Coming up after these announcements is Buscando America, so stay tuned. Ever wonder what happens to your Fred Meyer reward points? Now you can turn them into excellent community radio by linking your Fred Meyer rewards card to KBOO. Look up KBOO or our ID number 86634 at fredmeyer.com/community rewards. Every time you use your card, KBOO will get money.